Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And today I'm talking to a regular Media Cat writer, Emily Fairhead-Keane. Emily's a senior strategy partner at Wavemaker, and in her career has also worked at Mediacom, Visium, and Starcom MediaVest. Welcome, Emily.
Hey, Mike. Thank you very much for having me.
Good to do a little podcast. You've obviously written for us for a while. And actually, the subject of this chat is one of your recent-ish pieces that you wrote for us around kind of superhuman brands. So based off that sort of recent article, I understand that you sort of took that from a larger award-winning paper that you wrote, where you won the Grand Prix in Branding and Identity at the Atticus Awards in 2015. Is that sort of where this sort of all started?
Yeah, totally. It's kind of gone by in the blink of an eye. Was like yesterday, which now I sound very old, but yeah, it won the Atticus Prize in 2015. It was actually originally written for the IPA diploma course, which was run by Nick Kendall in, I think I wrote it in 2014 actually, and it won a prize there and then was published in Campaign and then won the Grand Prix at the Atticus Awards, which for anyone that doesn't know is kind of open to 115,000 employees at WPP. It's a bit of a Britain's Got Talent for thought leadership. But they really kind of emphasise the need to kind of be not only original and transformational, but kind of compelling and practical as well. So actually have kind of not sit on a kind of ivory tower of abstract thinking, but have practical implications too. But yes, I thoroughly enjoyed writing it and I've been talking a lot about it over the years.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I guess if that's 2015, it must have influenced quite heavily what you do, because, you know, that's obviously quite a few years ago now, I suppose. Can you kind of give us the main thrust of the paper? It's around sort of brands being more superhuman and godlike as opposed to, I don't know, being nice and understanding. I mean, what was the sort of main thrust of the argument?
Yeah, totally. I guess it wasn't that... It wasn't that I wanted brands or thought brands should be nasty as such versus nice, but I guess it went against the thinking that has kind of been dominant in the last 10, 15 years, which is that brands should be more human and kind of transparent and actually more understanding and explicitly authentic and empathetic. And actually, my point was actually brands aren't human. They actually are. There's a quote which is amazing, which is kind of brands are slippery, weird, and abstract, and it's the abstract and the ambiguous that people find them attractive. It's kind of they're a mystery box, a kind of container of infinite possibilities which continues to fascinate because it remains unopened. And actually brands should stay separate from people and not try and be like them. So I kind of countered that thinking. And within that, I guess, superhuman is, for me, three things. It's kind of they need to be more spectacular and impressive, and they need to be more opaque and kind of talk about their kind of fictional stories, not so much their kind of transparent backstories. And also that they need to kind of show an element of leadership and control. So kind of those are the three core principles of it.
That does sound a little bit like villains in storytelling and movies in a way, because it's like there's an argument in recent years that I've noticed pop up quite a few times where it's like you don't actually want or need your villain to have this like sympathetic backstory or anything like that. Like it's better that they're opaque because then they're just this sort of larger than life character. Maybe that's the link there to being a larger than life character as opposed to being more human, you know, I mean, the brand link, you know.
Totally. And also, I guess if you compare it to things like, I don't know, no one needs to know what your head teacher's private life was like, but you respect them because they are this kind of impressive figure that stands there at the lectern or whatever school you went to, wherever they stood. I think there's also a danger. I think the brands have gone so far down the authentic route that I'm not sure how much people trust their authenticity anyway. And it all feels a bit kind of faux authenticity in terms of backstories in their desperate desire to show their kind of transparent stories.
I mean, 2015, I guess, was a different time. It's always like hard to imagine. Then you have to like think back to a certain time. But how was, obviously you won an award for the paper at the time, but was it well received by everybody? Were there people that disagreed with you at the time?
I think people generally agreed because it was something that you felt you could get hold of, and there was quite a lot of emotion in the essay, and there was a lot of feel to it. And I think as a kind of, yes, we should be more ambitious as an industry, felt good for people. After winning the award, I was at a reception and Jeremy Bullmore was there and pulled me aside and said, "You must come and have a cup of tea," which at the time I thought, oh my good God, what am I going to say to him? Because he's obviously a total legend. And his point was, I love the essay, but all brands all of the time. And I thought, actually, he's probably right. It's not all brands all of the time. And then he sent me lots of articles that were incredibly interesting to read. And thought, yeah, maybe it's not toilet cleaners. Although looking at the likes of kind of the Kill It Bangs of this world, they've almost modelled themselves on that kind of stylistic, superhuman visual and actually look like something out of a Marvel comic. But I guess that's in their fake promise of cleaning anything off the toilet, or they're just they're garish visuals. I guess also people were quite interested, and I guess this has got even more, I was going to say worse, but it depends on what you think of it, but obsessed with marketing themselves and very good at being kind of curating and creating their identities and their feeds on their LinkedIn profiles and so forth. And I argued that we'd entered this marketing age, and I think that's just got more and more, and I don't think that's subsided at all. So generally, yes, apart from that tea with Jeremy Bullmore where he told me not all brands all of the time, generally, yes.
Well, I was going to say, actually, because in your article that you wrote for the magazine, you were talking about brands wowing us. And I was going to say, does it apply to all brands? Like, it's easier for a sexy brand versus like a washing up liquid, or, I don't know, selling, I don't know, machine parts or something. Like, can and should they be doing something bold and audacious and making up stories, or is that going to be overdone then? I don't know.
I don't know. It totally does depend on the brand of the category. I would say that arguably working on the more low interest categories like insurance is probably, you could argue, even more important to be superhuman and actually sell something more interesting than the product you've got. So working on NRMA insurance in Australia, was worked for a fantastic client over there whose mission it was to make every piece of creative that they put out there superhuman. And they heavily went after kind of impressing people rather than just selling products and obsessed with eyeballs and using media as a kind of vehicle. So I think you can almost argue the opposite, and that actually probably for low interest categories, it's even more important to be impressive and superhuman in an effort to kind of get people to buy you, or at least remember you.
Yeah, I think Kevin Chesters that writes for us wrote something along those lines once, saying it's easier to market a sexy product or brand or whatever and be all impressive and godlike and wow us with one of those, whatever it might be, versus something very mundane, some kind of mundane product or service. Like, how do you do that? I suppose to pivot slightly to another part of the thing you wrote in the article where you said brands should dominate us into submission, which quite liked as a phrase. I guess it's sits maybe in more of that godlike kind of territory, because our July theme of the magazine, for those that aren't aware listeners, is fame and attention, which is actually sort of part inspired by a podcast we did a couple of years ago with two of our contributors, Paul Feldwick and Faris Yacob, who both authors as well, both written books. He talks a lot about showmanship, and which kind of sounds a lot, when I remember when you sent me the article, it sounded a lot like that, just having the showman or being a showman as a brand, whether it's a front person of the brand or like CEO or the founder, or whether it's just the brand overall. Would you say that sort of sits in a similar space, kind of this sort of showmanship and wowing us, being godlike?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of being kind of memorable and engaging and kind of entertaining and impressive, I guess how you deliver on that showmanship is kind of ever changing. And 10 years ago, it might have been me talking about, I don't know, every brand should do a similar Chanel catwalk show or kind of deliver on that spectacle in a physical sense. And then you look at DoorDash's win this year at Cannes, and arguably that's showmanship, but in a slightly different form. And actually, the way that showmanship shows up as kind of the opportunities for that are kind of massively different to, I guess, 10 years ago. But yes, definitely in the showmanship and kind of spectacle and impressive kind of territory, I'd argue that you also need to be absolutely, explicitly in control of the brand itself and show that you're a kind of leader within that. And I talk a lot about within that scarcity and kind of the feeling that a brand might not be there makes people want it even more. And a brand that sets itself apart by having very distinctive rules, I think, is quite interesting as well. That's also part of this whole essay. And I think if you look at some of the brands now, particularly like the restaurant brands that literally, I mean, dominate people into submission, kind of maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, the hyperbole there, but they definitely make people kind of queue up around the block, snake around, which are obviously tactics that have been used for decades, or hang on the phone to the big mama group for kind of years trying to get a table at kind of, I don't know, 30 days in advance of when you're trying to get a table for. Like, they're all kind of tactics for, I guess, saying that a brand is dominant and in control and a leader. And then you look at the likes of kind of Coca-Cola, whenever they have competitions or they kind of have, I guess, opportunities for the people or the consumers to kind of get involved with a brand or co-create, they're all heavily kind of controlled and manufactured and manicured, and everything is absolutely templated and controlled. So I think that is a huge element of this argument, as well as the fictional piece, right? I think people want, kind of, especially in dark times, more fiction than ever before. And there's lots in the essay talking about bad times, like after the Industrial Revolution, where people didn't quite know how to behave, and the kind of the rise of things like fairies or kind of Superman literally coming out of World War II and the Great Depression. It's absolutely proven.
So it's sort of something coming to save us, essentially.
Something not quite real either.
Well, I wanted to touch on part of the thing that you put in your article about brands being more mysterious and opaque. And I don't know, it got me thinking back to college days of the old ADA model that I remember from my marketing times. Attention, interest, desire, action, for those that don't know it, I'm sure everyone does. And it kind of, a lot of the mystery sounds like that sort of early part of that, you know, the humans want to figure out a mystery, right, and work it out. So you kind of get their attention and their interest from that, just from not revealing everything all the time, or making things seem obscure. I can't remember if it was you that gave me the example in the article, or I saw it somewhere else, but it was like a shop front window or something where you couldn't see inside, but there was a queue outside. It was like a simple sort of what's in there, and you humans must know, you know, we must find it out.
Exactly. It's the people queuing for the Moonswatch watch for kind of hours outside Swatch, or the kind of, the fashion brands do it really well, and it kind of makes people want to know physically when you see a queue like that what's inside. But I also think I think it counters lots of the oversharing, people pouring their lives and souls and latest diets and grief and pretty much everything into their social feeds. And I think people are weighed down by an oversharing of everything, and I think brands are the ones that should kind of keep something back purely for that sense of mystery and opaque that gets people excited. There's supposed to be things that people get excited about and are interested by, not kind of best friends. And I think the whole thing got slightly confused when social media came onto the horizon, and you literally had real humans talking to people in the voice of a brand, and that became, that crossed a lane, I think, and brands didn't quite know how to navigate that.
Yeah, that's true. I was about to say, like, you know, it's part of the reason that they're getting pulled in too many directions, keeping up with trends and memes and social media and purpose marketing and whatever else you want to, the latest thing, you know, brands, marketers trying to do way too many things and sort of forgetting to kind of go back to this kind of core essence, perhaps of, you know, creating some kind of desire, I suppose, for what they do.
Yeah, totally. I think we're obviously an industry totally obsessed with the new, and where legacy is almost a dirty word. Joe Arden's just written a brilliant article about the power of the past. And I think we just jump on so much stuff all the time. Charlie Ebdy's just also written a really, really good article that he's published independently about how we shouldn't necessarily just jump on the next thing. And actually, it's okay to say you shouldn't be first mover, or we should wait. And obviously heavily references kind of NFTs. I think the point around too much transparency is also, I think brands that miss out are the ones that think people want to know everything about them. And actually, if you look at the likes of Amazon, no one really needs to know how they actually get the cherries to your door in under 40 minutes or whatever. They just want the end benefit. And actually, the magic and mystery of how some of these brands operate is actually almost is impressive in itself. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, those kind of brands are almost like air, and actually people respect them in that they're almost kind of slightly an invisible part of the ecosystem, and people just kind of take the fact that they get you stuff and it's effortless and it's almost superhuman in the way that they have their customer service set up to deliver seamlessly.
Well, I was thinking, like, do you think brands have forgotten the power that they have or could have in terms of influencing people and culture? Do you think some of them have sort of lost their way, or maybe not realized what they could be doing?
Yeah, I totally think so. And I also think as an industry, we've become very doom and gloom and actually all jumped on purpose, because I think I'm quoting Ritson here, that said that we all love purpose because it means we're not queuing up at the gates of hell with the estate agents. But it's actually, we're enormously creative. The industry's got so much potential to create really phenomenal work. And brands are magical, mysterious, weird and wonderful things that people pay more for versus other things. And I think we've lost sight of maybe some of the ambition or the power that we have, or if we have power, we're almost too apologetic about it. And every marketer, every agency loves putting the chart up that says no one gives a shit about brands, and brands are kind of, no one really cares about them. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think we kind of really do ourselves a disservice as an industry. I had someone about 5 years ago say to me, it was an old client actually, that said, well, we're not movie makers. Why should we have that ambition? And it's like, well, you look at the brands that have the ambition to be movie makers and hire movie makers and have that element of swagger that Hollywood does, and they're the ones that are winning. So I do think we are in pockets losing a sense of ambition and pride in what we do.
Yeah, I guess, well, even on a normal movie making level, like a lot of A-list directors that we know these days made their mark in like making adverts, you know, and they're trying to create the kind of something quite cinematic maybe for a brand within some kind of advert in a small way, you know, like people like Ridley Scott and stuff back in the day.
Totally. And it's interesting, isn't it, the frequency at which we communicate with people and how movies are actually event and scarce and on one weekend that they open, and there's all the communication is built to that crescendo. In the article and the essay itself, I reference a book that was by Anita Elbers called Blockbusters, and she talks about the strategy for kind of publishers, music labels, TV networks, and generally the entertainment industry, and actually how they pace their communication is all around an event. And obviously John Lewis did that particularly well. They're probably the most famous example of people that kind of build up their communication into a blockbuster release. But I guess in an age where everyone's obsessed with always on and mental availability and saliency, what does blockbuster really look like if you actually save some of your money to do some stuff that was amazing and impressive and not always on? I think there's something quite interesting in that.
Yeah, it sounds very much the less is more approach. do less, but do it in a more impressive manner. I don't know.
And it doesn't always have to be an advert, does it?
No. Well, I'm just conscious of the time. I know we have to wrap up soon, but I wanted to ask maybe one or two last questions. One around, I suppose a tricky one. If brands are sort of acting in this kind of superhero, how do they balance acting in a kind of a superhero or godlike manner with being sort of sensitive to people's struggles, you know, around cost of living, etc.? Like, is that a tricky tightrope to tread or not really? Do you just essentially sidestep it?
I don't know. I think you can still be impressive and empathetic at the same time. I don't think you have to be kind of necessarily, I think you can be sensitive. I don't think you have to be a nasty brand. You don't have to be necessarily nasty and totally unempathetic and have no care for people and totally lacking in insight. I think you can be sensitive but impressive at the same time. And I think that's even more important now. I think you basically can be impressive and empathetic, and you don't necessarily need to be nasty.
Yeah, that's fair. I suppose it's not nasty necessarily, but more just aware of people's issues or connected to them, but they're not necessarily saying we're one of you, but they're saying, I guess, like you say, like the empathy is there, but they're still perhaps saying, you know, we're not just being like your buddy or anything. I don't know. I'm just trying to get the distinction right in my head, you know.
Exactly. They're not supposed to be best friends. They're supposed to be kind of more transcendental in a way and kind of more authoritative than on the ground with you. And I think whilst the language in advertising over the last 10 years has moved away slightly from that kind of literally pretending like you are a person, some of the kind of the copywriting and ads of the last 10 years has been very human. I think we've probably moved away from that, but we're still fairly on the ground with real people banging on about transparency. And I think brands need to be away from that and offer something that's better or superior or something that people can't do. I think that's really important. And I think brands can help people through the current challenges people are facing by not, as you say, being necessarily their best friends, but they're kind of being more of an authoritative figure. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that sounds like a good point on which to end, I think, in terms of wrapping up. But we'll put a link in the show notes to your article that was in the magazine as well. But yeah, just for now, just want to say thanks, Emily, so much for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you, Mike.